Good morning. On today's programme, the UK's plan to build the world's longest subsea power cable network and the Donald Trump-supporting war veteran who descends from witches. But first we go to Brazil, where authorities in a far-flung Amazon state fear a looming migration crisis due to the government in neighbouring Peru, which intends to expel undocumented migrants. Brazil fears that an influx of migrants, the vast majority of whom are Venezuelan, will overwhelm its fragile border facilities. From Sao Paulo, Sam Cowie reports.
Brazil's Amazonian state Acre sits on the border with Peru and Bolivia in the country's far northwest. With a population of 830,000, it's one of Brazil's least populated states, and its relative unimportance is somewhat of a national joke across the rest of the South American superpower. Acre, does it really exist? Goes a popular saying. Now, however, the far-flung and forgotten state is providing crucial services for thousands of Venezuelan migrants fleeing hardship. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, more than 7 million Venezuelans have left the country since 2015, the result of an acute economic crisis, with food and medicine shortages widespread. Some 1.5 million Venezuelans have settled in Peru, Brazil's neighbour. But for many migrants living in Peru, life is about to get harder, it seems. On November 10th, the Peruvian government plans to begin expelling undocumented migrants, including some 400,000 Venezuelans. Experts maintain that the Peruvian government clearly does not have the capacity to physically expel so many people. But they also say that the threat of expulsion and the climate of fear that comes with it is likely enough to encourage many migrants to pack up and search for opportunities elsewhere. Authorities in Acre fear that an uptick in the number of migrants fleeing to Brazil will overwhelm the state's fragile shelter facilities, which are already at breaking point, with a significant increase in the number of Venezuelans crossing into the state this year and last, seeking refuge. This new policy from the Peruvian government worries us a lot because we will be that first place where the migrants will go, said Leticia Mamed, a professor and researcher at the Federal University of Acre. Brazil is the third country that has received the most Venezuelan migrants in South America, with more than 477,000 as of August 2023. That's behind Colombia with 2.9 million and Peru's 1.5 million, according to the Council for Refugees and Migrants from Venezuela. In recent years, observers have noticed an increase in xenophobia towards migrants in Peru, where President Dina Boluarte has publicly blamed foreigners for an uptick in crime. At the country's traditional Independence Day address at the end of July, she reiterated her commitment to expelling undocumented migrants. There will be no extension. Those who do not meet the deadline to request regularization will be expelled from the country, she said. Cecile Bluin, a professor at the Catholic University of Peru, said that the Peruvian president's speech reflects the current climate in the country. It's a speech that reflects a lot of xenophobia in the government, in Congress, in all of the powers of the state, but also in the population, she said. Many experts note that xenophobia in Peru has grown alongside a prolonged political crisis. Dina Boluarte is the seventh Peruvian president since 2015. In December last year, she took over from left-wing Pedro Castillo, for whom she served as vice president. Castillo was himself impeached by Congress and detained on charges of attempting a coup. Since then, Boluarte has faced calls to resign, and more than 60 people were killed in protests earlier this year. Currently, 90% of the population reject her mandate, and 94% of the population reject the current Congress. While the Peruvian government only intends to expel undocumented migrants, experts and migrants themselves note how difficult it is to legalize their situations in Peru. In Peru, it's very difficult to get documentation. I practically didn't exist in Peru. I couldn't open a bank account, said Adriana Velez Jimenez, a 37-year-old Venezuelan migrant who spent nearly 5 years living in Peru. In contrast, Brazil's open arms approach to refugees and migrants allows foreigners to use its social safety net and claim state benefits. It is lauded by migration experts across the world. Ms. Ramirez now lives in Rio Branco, capital of Brazil's Acre state, where authorities fear migrants fleeing Peru will overwhelm local shelter facilities. A former bank worker, today Ms. Ramirez works as a street vendor and sells coconut water in a public square. Last week, Brazil prosecutors, the Labor Department and public defenders called for the creation of a contingency plan to provide shelter and help vulnerable migrant families crossing from Peru into Brazil. But life for migrants in Brazil, and especially in poorer states like Acre, is often far from easy. It's difficult to make money, Ms. Ramirez said. I have an extensive CV, but I can't get a formal job. I have a young son, and I can't go very far. For World Report in Sao Paulo, I'm Sam Cowie.
Next, we go to the UK, which has classified a project to lay 4 undersea cables to carry electricity generated in Morocco to England as a project of national significance. The designation will make it easier for Xlinx, the company behind the scheme, to get planning permission to build the world's longest subsea power cable network, which would be 3,800 kilometres long. As Russell Padmore reports from London, the project would transport energy generated from renewable sources in Africa to the United Kingdom.
The plan to bring electricity from Morocco to Devon in the southwest of England will mean building 4 high-voltage undersea cables. The aim of the scheme is to supply power generated by wind turbines and solar panels in the Sahara Desert to 7 million homes here in the UK by 2030. Morocco's investment in clean energy projects is making the country an example of how to combat climate change by using natural resources. In 2009, the government in Rabat set out an ambitious plan to have 42% of its power generated from renewable energy within a decade. That has yet to be achieved, but the policy has driven a huge expansion of projects to generate electricity from wind turbines and solar panels. A major example is the Nur Wer Zerzet complex, the world's largest concentrated solar power plant. An array of curved mirrors spread over 3,000 hectares, which focus the rays of the sun onto tubes of fluid, creating hot liquid to produce power. The economic policy of the Moroccan government to export renewable power, much of it generated in the Sahara Desert, could help to reduce Europe's reliance on energy from Russia amid the war in Ukraine. The Xlinx cables from North Africa will provide 8% of the UK's electricity. Last year at the United Nations COP27 Climate Change Conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Morocco signed a memorandum of understanding with France, Germany, Portugal and Spain to make it easier to sell power across borders. The Xlinx project will initially create 10,000 jobs in Morocco, leading to 2,000 permanent ones. But many challenges lie ahead, including securing permission from France, Portugal and Spain to lay the electricity cables through their offshore territories. But that arrangement signed at COP27 between Morocco and 4 EU countries may help. The plan is to bury the cables under the seabed or ocean floor along most of the route, at depths between 100 and 250 metres deep. Xlinx says it will need additional funding for the project, which could cost up to £22 billion. That's about €25 billion. The company has described the British government's recognition of its project as a major milestone. Ireland is also taking advantage of the technology to use high-voltage cables to import electricity. The Green Link connected with Wales, which is planned to be commissioned next year, will link Wexford and the national grid to supplies of power in Britain and the Nordic countries. Plus, there is the plan to build the Celtic interconnector to import power from France, as well as allow electricity generated by Irish suppliers to be sold to the French. The project will install the same type of undersea high-voltage direct current, or HVDC, cables as the ones planned between Morocco and the UK. The Celtic interconnector between Cork and Brittany will be 575 kilometres long, and it's supported by funding of €1.6 billion from the European Union. The line to supply power between Ireland and France is scheduled to be completed by 2026, 4 years ahead of the scheme to transport electricity from Morocco to the UK. The British power supply from North Africa will be generated from renewable sources, but will the Celtic interconnector provide the same green energy to Ireland? The government has said it will reduce the cost of electricity and in future allow the export of Irish green energy from planned offshore wind power projects. France uses nuclear power stations to generate about 2/3 of its electricity, So could Ireland be getting some of that through the interconnector? Governments around the world are under pressure to reduce the impact of climate change by increasing the use of electricity generated from renewable sources instead of using oil and gas. The world's longest power cable network between North Africa and the UK will create more energy security for Britain, as well as boost the economy of Morocco. In just a few years, when I turn on my Chinese-made kettle to make tea from India, I could be using electricity from Africa. This is Russell Padmore for World Report in London.
Finally, we go to the United States, and on this Halloween weekend, the story of a Donald Trump-supporting former war veteran who discovered to his surprise that he descends from witches who were murdered during the infamous Salem witch trials in the late 1600s. Now this great-grand son of a witch has embraced his ancestry, as Alice Hutton reports.
In 2013, Christopher Cirillo was on active duty in Iraq on a reconnaissance mission. By that fateful day, the then 44-year-old staff sergeant from New Jersey had been in the Marine Corps for 22 years without serious injury. "I'd signed up as a kid," the now 54-year-old said from his current home in sunny Cathedral City, California. "My brothers called me the Khaki King. I wanted to be that guy who charges the beach. I always figured that eventually my luck would run out, and it did." Christopher and the rest of his infantry were ambushed with machine gun fire, and he took a full blast to the head. That should have been the end of the story. By some miracle, he survived and was left alive, but with a lifelong traumatic brain injury. Forced to retire early, he turned to a hobby that is increasing in popularity across America, family genealogy, and gaining access to prestigious historical membership clubs, the most famous of which, perhaps, is the Mayflower Society, for descendants of the Pilgrims who sailed to the New World in 1620. "I was struggling with my health," said Christopher. "I had a lot of neurological issues. I was forgetting things. So I wanted to find out that my ancestors were heroes to make me feel better." Using birth, marriage, death, and property records to trace his line back, not only did he discover that he had 39 ancestors who fought in the Revolutionary War of 1775 to 1783, granting him access to the 135-year-old Sons of the American Revolution Club, but he accidentally discovered something much more surprising. The Trump-voting, anti-abortion, pro-gun rights Republican was also the son of a witch. Two, actually. During the course of his research, Christopher had accidentally stumbled across the fact that both of his 8 times great-grandmothers, Suzanne Martin and Elizabeth Howe Jackson, were murdered during the infamous Salem witch trials of 1692 to 93, during which an outbreak of religious hysteria in Massachusetts resulted in the killing of 20 innocent people for witchcraft. "I was stunned," he said. "I'm a Roman Catholic, because that's how I grew up. I'm not overly religious, but I have strong convictions. But witches? I always think of that Monty Python sketch. She's a witch. I did not expect this at all." He immediately set about becoming a member of the rare club Son of a Witch, which was founded in 1975 and only has 600 members, compared to 31,000 in the Mayflower Society, for example. The field of witch genealogy in the US has long been dominated by women, feminists, and Democrats, who often feel drawn to the strong female figures at the heart of the Salem trials. In the last few years, however, it has gone mainstream, with tourism organizations offering holidays to places where witches were murdered. Some academics suggest the revival is a byproduct of far-right attacks on women's rights. In 2019, the New York Times announced, "Witches are having a resurgence amongst feminists who want authority over their lives." All of which makes Christopher not just an unusual male enthusiast, but, given his politics, an even rarer exception. "I don't think men really care," he said. "Men are men. They want to be associated with a general, or a Viking, or George Washington. But I see courage, principle, stamina, and strength in those women. There's a sense of pride in knowing you can prove it." Has it changed his politics at all? Well, just ask him what his membership number is. 45, he crows, just like someone else we know who's the subject of a witch hunt, referring to the criminal charges against former President Donald Trump over accusations that he attempted to overturn the 2020 election. For Christopher, it is about remembering and learning lessons from the dead. He is even cheerfully planning to buy a holiday home in Salem, if he ever comes into enough money. I went to visit 2 years ago. I took my wife. We loved it. Who doesn't want a vacation in the place where your ancestors were murdered? This is Alice Hutton for World Report.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, for myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.